Good morning. It is great to see you. Welcome to Morgantown Community Church. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, that was much, like two people said that to me at 9 o'clock. The rest were like, nah. So I'm glad it's working out well for you. Couple things before we jump in. We are currently in have some opportunities for some volunteers in our children's ministry at both services. So if you come to this service and you'd be willing maybe every other week to help out at 9 o'clock, we have an opening there. And then we also have one at 10:30. So if you would be open to coming at 9 o'clock every other week and do like whatever works for you. But we need to have some folks who are willing to do that so we can continue to do good stuff for our kids. You can see Adria about that. You can see me about that. And we'll get you put you right to work. So New Year, I don't know what you did on New Year's Eve. We went to a gathering with some friends, a lot of fun. But that morning, about 8 a.m., I went out to, FedEx came to my house. Does anybody else have like, it's just a great experience when FedEx drops a package. You may also get that way. Like you just get a little giddy. Well, it ended up being for Carlo, which is a big disappointment. But anyway, so I'm going out, I go out the garage and there's gravel and I'm going to step on the sidewalk and then go to the front porch and get the package. And I have an ankle that has some screws and plates and stuff in it and it's kind of weak. And apparently when I landed, I hit a certain way and the whole ankle went up underneath me and I fell in slow motion for 5 minutes. Like it was, and our road is usually kind of quiet. It was like a caravan of people driving by and they see, and I'm literally, it's literally 5 minutes. Like that's happening. I hit the ground and I'm afraid, I just know they're all laughing at me. I'm afraid to look up. And then I'm afraid because the day it is, you know, it's New Year's Eve. I'm thinking he started early and you know, I'm laying out there in the yard. It reminded me of the story from the book of Acts on the day of Pentecost when the Spirit comes and they're all speaking in different languages and somebody says, they're drunk. And Peter says, it's only 9 in the morning. Like I felt like I need to stand up and go, it's only 8 a.m. Don't. So there was that. And then do you guys make New Year's resolutions? Anybody do that? Anybody? A couple of you? How many of you have broken them yet? Like 9 o'clock? Every hand went up. I was like, 3 days, people? 3 days? I've decided this year to not make positive New Year's resolutions. I'm going to make negative ones. And here's what I mean. I usually make the same resolutions. I'm going to eat better. I'm going to exercise. And I do that for a couple days and then it goes away. I've decided this year to do the opposite. I'm going to eat worse. In 2016, I'm going to exercise less. And what I hope happens is the same pressure that eating better puts on me, I hope that like the pressure now to eat worse, I'll do the best. You see what I'm saying? Like I think it's a very Seinfeld thing to do, but that's what I've decided to do. So I'm hoping that at some point somebody will put something fried in front of me and I'll say, no, I don't want to eat worse this year because it's my goal. So that's what I'm hoping. So if you see me out, then maybe you can encourage me to eat poorly and then I'll make good choices. So that's just purely for me, not for you. Let's do this. I want to start a series today called Core. And it's going to be 4 weeks about our church and about our values. And basically, our mission is always in front of us, which is to empower people to take the next step. But how we do that, how we go about that mission is what I want to talk about. How do we, what are the values that shape our church and give our church direction? We used to have a really long list, and last year we cut them down to 4. And we tried to incorporate everything into those 4, but we realized that when you try to get people to talk about your values and they have like 25 things, you kind of lose that. So I want to talk about 4 things over the next 4 weeks that as a church we value, and that as our leaders are thinking about the direction of our church and what we do and where we go and the kind of things we talk about, kind of things that we, like people we bring in, whatever we do, ends up being filtered through these 4 things. So before we jump into that, though, let's just, I want to do something we've been trying to do lately, and that's just to give us a minute to be silent and for you to think about, pray about whatever you're carrying with you, whatever you need to get out there. And I'll kind of wrap it up with a short prayer at the end, and then we'll jump into the teaching. So let's just take about a minute in silence. God, we're grateful for this day, for this moment. We ask for open hearts, open minds to receive and a willingness to enact the things we talk about today. We love you. We pray in Jesus' name. And everybody said, Amen. So if you have a Bible, turn to Genesis chapter 1. I want to start there. Today I want to begin a journey through our values by talking about that we value, here at MCC, we value the image of God in every single human being. I want to talk about what that means to say that we value the image of God that's present in every single human being. And we'll touch a lot of important things as we go on this journey. But I want to begin in Genesis 1. The Bible begins with two creation stories. And these two creation stories come from two different sources. One of the creation stories, the oldest one, is found in Genesis 2 and 3. And it's the most familiar one. It's the Garden of Eden. It's the talking snake. It's the fruit. It's Adam and Eve, right? That's probably the more familiar one in some ways. But then in Genesis 1, there's another creation story. And it's actually the newer one, but they put it first when they compiled Genesis. And this story is about 6 days of creations and a seventh day of rest, right? God creates the world in 6 days and rests on the seventh day. And so we get the idea of Sabbath and this rhythm of work and rest. But in Genesis 1, what we think about the source of this Genesis 1 text is it actually came from what we call in biblical scholarship, we call the priestly source. And when I say priestly source, we think that this Genesis 1 creation story, it's actually a poem in Hebrew, this creation poem was written or compiled by a group of priests. Because essentially it lays creation out like a temple, and we'll see that as we kind of go through. But if you're a priest and your job is to be at the temple all the time and thinking about the temple and doing temple things, then it's natural that when you think of the entire creation, you're going to think in terms of creation as a temple, right? It's this place where God creates. Because what's the theory behind the temple? We create a space, and who lives there? God, right? That's the theory behind it. We kind of have come far enough to realize God has never lived in buildings. But back then, they thought God lived in these spaces they created, holy spaces, and that if we do the right things and go through the right rituals, then somehow that makes God present to us. And again, we don't think that anymore, but that was in our heritage. And so here's how Genesis 1, God, for 6 days, God's created. And this is the sixth day. God begins by creating basically forms. You know, earth and separating earth from sea, and then eventually God fills them with things. He fills the sky with stars and suns and moons, and then he starts creating stuff on earth, plant life. And then on the sixth day, God made every kind of wildlife, every kind of livestock, and every kind of creature that crawls on the ground, and God saw how good it was. You realize Genesis is saying that mosquitoes are good. Right, if you've never disagreed with the Bible, I think this is the moment where you say, absolutely not, something's gone wrong. But this is everything God makes is good. God said, let us make humanity in our image to resemble us, so that they may take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the earth, and all the crawling things on earth. God created humanity in God's own image. In the divine image, God created them, male and female, God created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and master it. Take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, and everything crawling on the ground. Then God said, I now give to you all the plants on earth that yield seeds and all the trees whose fruit produces its seed within it. They will be your food. To all wildlife, to all the birds in the sky, and to everything crawling on the ground, to everything that breathes, I give all the green grasses for food. God saw everything he had made. It was supremely good. There was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. On the sixth day, God creates animals. He creates livestock, dogs, unmentionable things like cats, right? So as you know, we have a cat now in my house. I know you do. We have a cat at my house now, and her name is Izzy, and I call her Rusifi because that's what they call the Lucifer cat on Cinderella, and that's just what I call her. She's owning it. And this is why I have problems with cats, if I can just tell you. It's because they have this evil intent about them. Like, when you walk out the door, they immediately try to trip you. Have you noticed? Like, they're just immediately around your feet, like, I'll get you, sucker. You know what I mean? Like, and you have to be very careful. Well, yesterday I went outside to feed the cat because I'm nothing if not humane. And I went outside to feed the cat. I ended up sitting down on the porch for a second, and this cat walks over and gets in my lap and starts purring. And then I had this awful instinct just to pet the cat. And so I'm sitting there just petting the cat, and she looks up at me, and I said, you better not tell anybody that this happened. But here I am in my safe space. God makes everything and calls it good. But after God makes all the livestock and all the animals, then God makes people. And when God makes people, God makes them differently than he makes everything else. And we talked about last week, there's something about us that's different than everything else in creation. Something different about the human being that's different. And Genesis 1 says it's because human beings were made in God's image. Now, people since Genesis 1 has been out there have been wrestling with the idea, what does that mean to be made in God's image? Some people, well, we know it's not. We know it can't be that we look like God, right? For several reasons. One, God is spirit. So God doesn't have a body. There is no old man in the sky. God doesn't have flesh and blood like we do. God is spirit, right? And so spirit doesn't have... So all the things we say about God, the hand of God, right? That's all metaphor to describe the actions of God. But God doesn't have a body. There is no old man turning knobs in the sky with a really long beard. It just doesn't exist. God, the way we talked about God here is if you imagine that we're fish, God is the water, right? God is like the air we breathe. God is everywhere. God doesn't live in a building. God doesn't live in the sky. God is present in all of creation. And so we know it can't be that we look like God. And another reason we know that is we all look really different, right? I mean, you may find an identical twin, set of identical twins out there who are identical, but I bet you that their parents can tell them apart, right? Because no two human beings are exactly alike. So it can't be that we look like God. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? Some people have suggested, and I think there's something to this, that it's our consciousness that is the image of God in us. The fact that more than anything else in creation, you and I are conscious. We're self-conscious. We're self-aware. Most of us are self-aware. We have this sense of a place in the world, and we have questions about the world, and we have questions about the universe, right? We talked about this last week. As much as you love, you know, Spot, your dog, Spot doesn't wonder about the universe or why it works. He just takes it for granted. You and I ask questions about it. You and I wonder about our place in the world. We've actually woke up in the morning and wondered, what is the meaning of life? Right? So some people say that maybe that is the image of God present in us. I love, anybody know the poet Mary Oliver? Anybody read Mary Oliver? I've just really been turned on to her work in the last 6 to 8 months, and she is amazing. She says this, maybe the desire to make something beautiful is the peace of God that is inside each of us. I mean, how many of you have ever looked at something, a sunset, a piece of art, and ever been moved by it? Anybody? Yeah, and it's just, how many of you have ever gone to a museum and you've looked at art and there was nothing, no redeeming value other than the fact that it was beautiful? Anybody ever had that experience? Like, you realize, this is just beautiful. Yeah, I think there's something, and sometimes we've done art nights here at church where we'll come and people will come and bring their art supplies and we'll just work paint for a couple hours. And what's astounding to me is that I'll be in the same room with people like Gail, and Gail will create something that's beautiful and everybody's like, oh, that's amazing. And then I turn around and show them what I've made and they're like, did your kid do that? That's your kid. Your kid did that, right? And yet there are these people who can bring beauty into the world through music and through art and through dance and through all sorts of things that I feel like it's a gift to the world that I don't do them, right? That's my gift to the world. That's how I make more beauty in the world. I do less of those things personally. And there's something about that. Maybe it is the ability just to stand back and look at the world and see how beautiful it is, like God does at the end of creation, and go, oh, this is supremely good. And I think that's valid too. But when I think what's really going on here, beyond all that sort of thing, what it means to be made in the image of God has to do with how this writer of this particular creation story sees creation. It's a priestly writer, and his mindset is temple. And if in a temple, you would build a temple, and one of the last things you would do is you would install an image of the God into it. What's another word for an image? An idol. Right, the last thing you would do in a temple before you did the ribbon cutting or whatever they did in the ancient world is you would put the image of the God in the temple as a place, as a representative of the God. Now, nobody in the ancient world really believed that those images, wood and stone and metal, nobody really believed that was the God. But they believed that was where they could come in contact with the God, that represented the God in the temple. And so that they're, you know, that's why they put them in their homes. It represents the God in this space. When God makes his temple, which, by the way, is not a building, it's all of creation. What's the last thing God installs in God's temple? An image. The last thing in creation in Genesis 1 is what? Human beings. And God places in the temple of creation his images. These human beings which are placed to represent God to the rest of the world. To be human is to be the image bearer of God. And to be the image bearer of God is to be the representative of God in the world. That's what an idol did in the temple. You represented God. That's our role in the world. Every human being has been made in the image of God. Every single one. And here's what that means. Before anything else, part of valuing the image of God in everybody, it means that before anything else, we realize we're all human beings. Before we're anything else, we're human. Before you're a Christian or a Muslim, you're human, right? Before you are any ethnicity, before you are any nationality, you're human. Before you're gay or straight, human. Before you are a Louisville fan or a Kentucky fan, you're human, right? Before, and this is pertinent to our community, before you're a yes voter or a no voter, you're a human. You see what I'm saying? We have all these labels we affix to each other in society, and the labels do two things. One, it tells people how to sell things to us, right? If I can label Bob, I know what to sell to Bob, right? This is who Bob is. I need to sell this to him. If I can label you, I can sell to you. But even bigger than that, if I label you, then I know who to exclude, right? If I label you, I know who the us is, and I know who the them is. And if I know who the them is, then I can keep myself. I'm Irish today. Praise and begara. I don't even know if I can keep going. I can keep myself safe from all the thems, right? Because we've been intrinsically taught that there's an us and there's a them, there's a good and there's a bad. And if I can keep myself safe from the bad, then it's all good, right? And here's the problem with labels, though. What labels fail to appreciate is that beyond all those things, we're still human. And what labels end up doing, and at some points they're necessary identity markers, but what labels end up doing in the worst possible way is they essentially end up telling us that there are people who are subhuman. They're not like us. And if they're not like us, then it's okay to judge them. It's okay to kill them. It's okay to exclude them. That's what labels do. Ultimately, at their kind of worst scenario, labels tell us who is not okay. And when God creates, God doesn't create a Christian. God doesn't create a Jew or Muslim or a Hindu. God creates a human being. And all those other things have bubbled out of that creation of human beings. But in the beginning, there was human and there was God and it was good. Beyond your labels. And sometimes we don't even choose the labels that are put on us, right? When you were in school, how many of you chose to be a geek? Like you just like started first grade. I'm going to be a geek. I'm going to own it. Nobody chooses that, right? We get put, you know, if you've ever been at least in Eastern Kentucky, in the high school cafeteria, there were clear tables. It was like Mean Girls, sort of, right? There were clear tables where this is where the jocks sit. This is where the smart kids sit. This is where I sit, right? My group of people. And if we can just know who they are, we can keep them. But to honor the image of God in everybody means that when I approach you, my first question about you is not, what are all the labels that are affixed to you? My first question about you is, are you human? Because if you're human, the image of God is present in you. Now, is it possible that we have obscured that image, that we've made choices that have kind of pushed that image down, that we've not honored that image of God in ourselves? Absolutely. I think if you look at the world, you can realize that human beings have such potential to do such good, and yet we choose to do such wrong. Are you with me? No, you're listening to her. You're not with me. I know it's adorable. But I don't even know what I was saying now. Let's put it like this. To be made in the image of God transcends our goodness or badness. That's still present. Right? And that's hard. That's hard sometimes because we'll talk about it. There are some times when we want to deny that image of God in people for what we feel like are really, really, really good reasons. And yet it's present. Before we're anything, before we're anybody, before we play a role, before we're mom and dad or whatever, before we're any of those things, we are human beings and we are called to image God in the world. And if you notice the role God gives people, it's take care of creation. Now, this is not, in a sense, is how it's been interpreted, like abuse creation, mistreat creation, do whatever you want with creation. This is like, you're God's representative in creation. Take care of creation. Take care of God's masterpiece as God would take care of it. How many of you ever, when you were younger, did house sitting for anybody? Anybody ever do any house sitting? Did you throw a party? This is public confession, Bob. You want to get this out real quick? You sat in the bad seat today. This is just where I'm going today for all my inspiration. Now, when you house sit for somebody, you don't go in there and they're gone and you don't think, you know, they need a new door in their kitchen over there. I'm going to go get a sledgehammer and knock a hole in it. Do you? No, why? It's not your house. You're just sitting in it to make sure nobody else does anything bad to it. What is our role? This is not our world. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. We are temporary residents on a planet, and we've been called to care for it, to love it, and to be good to it. People, you can make fun of tree huggers all day long, but if there is a planet left, it's going to be because somebody's taking care of it. And when you take care of Earth, Earth takes care of you. How many of you have ever had a garden before? I had one successful one once. One. I've tried several, had one successful one once, and it was amazing how you could go outside your backyard and there is actual growing living things that you can bring inside and eat and take care of your family with. It's beautiful. When you take care of Earth, Earth takes care of you. So first and foremost, to honor the image of God means that we meet people before any of the other labels they have on them. We try to see every human being as that, a human being made in the image of God. Second, we seek to understand that every human being is unique. That is a really nice way of saying everybody's weird, right? And that's including you and that's including me. I mean, some of us are weirder than others. I'll give you that. But it's a way of understanding every human being is diverse, and diversity is a good thing. Can you imagine if we were all the same? What I love about our church is a couple weeks ago after 9 o'clock, somebody was coming out of our church and he stopped me and said, I just want you to know, I disagree with everything you say. I said, all right. And he said, but you make me think, I'll see you next week. And I thought, what a great world this is, right? That somebody comes in and listens to me babble like a maniac for 40 minutes every week and they don't agree with any of it. And they come back because they like to think. I think that's beautiful. I think that I can get up and say the things I say and give you the permission to say, hey, look, you don't have to agree with me to go here. And some of you like love that and that you don't agree with me. And yet you're here and we're in community and we take the bread and we take the cup and we do it together. I think that's beautiful. I think it's beautiful. The world is a diverse place. And if it were not diverse, it would be boring. If everybody had my skill set and my view of the world, nothing good would get done. There would be no art. There would be none of the good, beautiful things we love in the world, right? We're all different. We're all unique. And we've all been shaped by our experiences, by our culture, by who our parents were, who our family was, where we were born. Like, we can't escape those things, right? We are shaped by the environment we're brought into, which means if you would have grown up in, if you would have grown up in Germany post-World War II, before 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell, if you would have grown up in West Germany, East Germany, you'd been a different person, right? You would have been. If you'd have grown up in Saudi Arabia, you would just be a different person. You would be. It's not that you would be just you and you would live over there. You would be a completely different person. Our experiences in life shape us in all sorts of ways. And most of us are unaware of those things until we're dating someone and we bring them around our family. How many of you have ever taken somebody to meet your parents and your grandparents and all those people and it terrified you? Anybody had that experience? Fair. Now, I have the microphone. Now, why is that terrifying? Can we think about why that's terrifying? Here's why it's terrifying. It's terrifying because deep down, even though you won't admit it, you know your family's weird. And your biggest fear is that this normal person you're bringing into the house is going to find out that you're part of this weird, dysfunctional group of people and that they're going to leave a them-sized hole in the wall, right? But what you don't know about them is that their family's just as weird and messed up as yours because we're all a little bit different. And that difference, that diversity, that uniqueness, it's how God made the world. And it's God's intention for the world. Not that we would be like homogenized and the same, but that we would all be different and that our differences actually could be strengths. If three people in the same room all have the same strengths, it's not going to be as effective as three people with different strengths. Right? And so there's this sense of we're all unique, we're all diverse, and that's what really makes the world a beautiful, interesting place is that we can bring all of our different gifts and all of our different opinions. After the 9 o'clock service, I was talking with somebody and they pointed something out that they found interesting that I missed. And I thought, man, can you imagine if everybody just thought like me, I would have totally missed that brilliant insight into something we talk about this morning. Next, I would say, and this is where people jump off. This is when you get to these conversations, honoring the image of God in every human being, people begin to push back and say, what about those human beings? And by those human beings, I mean the people who've done bad things in the world. Right? There are people who've done bad things in the world. And people who are abusive do not need to be free in the world to continue to be abusive. Murderers do not need to be free to murder. Right? Abusers do not need to be free to abuse. There has to be some sort of justice for people who have done these sorts of awful things in the world. And when we talk about honoring the image of God in everybody, there's this tension that necessarily is created between how do I honor the image of God in Hitler or Charles Manson, and yet they get held accountable for the rotten things they've done in the world. right? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you see this tension? And so when you talk about love and you talk about forgiveness and you talk about all these things, there's this natural pushback in us, but they need to be held accountable for what they've done. And they do. Now, we may disagree on what accountable looks like depending on your beliefs, but the reality is I think we all know that people who have done bad things need to be held accountable for their actions. There are some people who have done such heinous things they should never see the light of day again. They need to be in jail. They need to be kept away from everybody else. And yet at the same time, we have to be very careful not to dehumanize those people, because even the worst of us were made in the image of God. Have you ever watched a documentary on like a serial killer? Yeah, what if they ever interview the parents? Inevitably, you know what the mom is going to. It's always usually the mom. Do you know what the mom's going to say? Something like, "That's still my boy." Think about that. I've sat down with people whose kids have done some pretty bad things, and their kids are older, 40, 50 years old. And I mean, that's not old, but you know what I'm saying? They're not 20 anymore, and they're older. And you'll sit down, and I remember this mother looking at me from across the table, and she said, "But that's still my baby." Now, if you can take that feeling a parent has for a child, no matter what that child has done, you take that feeling, even if the parent is disappointed and doesn't agree with that child, you take that feeling and you multiply it times infinity, and you're not even close to, I think, the way that God feels about the world. And so even the worst of us is still loved by God. And I know that's tough for us, but it's true. And if we're not careful in dehumanizing the people who've hurt us, and dehumanizing, and when I say dehumanizing, you know the things I'm talking about. It's when you start calling them, you know, they're animals, they're beasts, they're idiots, they're stupid. You know, it's when we start fixing all these words to people and we don't recognize first and foremost that there's a person there. Even a person who's done some really awful things, who needs to be held to account for the awful things he or she has done. Yes, they need to be held to account. But we have to hold this tension between justice and dignity. If we get to the point where we don't dignify human life, then it becomes really easy to do that on mass scale. When our enemies become expendable, then we've got big trouble. When we can think about just killing everybody we disagree with no thought that that's an actual human being with family. You see what I'm saying? These things are not, I don't have all the answers, but what I'm saying is these situations that we think are so cut and dry aren't. And to honor the image of God in everybody, we have to hold this tension between justice and dignity. I'll tell you this. There are some people who've hurt you so deeply, you need to live at least 5 zip codes away from them. And they do not need to be invited to Thanksgiving dinner. Right? There are some people who are so toxic that they have to be cut out of your life. And you can do that and still recognize the humanity that they possess. Right? You can say, "Look, I wish you well. I hope for your transformation and for mine. You need to stay away from me because we are toxic." Right? But when you dehumanize somebody, I think we lose out on one of the most beautiful things about our faith. And that is that we actually believe God can change and transform any human being. Really believe that. That no human being is outside of God's grace and love and ability to transform. And when we throw people's humanity away, we lose that hope that maybe they never need to get out of jail, but my goodness, maybe they could become a different person. You see what I'm saying? Are you with me? And then I would say we have to seek understanding and not fear. We have to seek understanding and not fear. And our media is doing a really good job right now of giving us the latter, right? It's giving us fear. We know who to be afraid of or who to tell us to be afraid of. And I think the problem is that what we do when we become afraid is we dehumanize other people. And the way to get beyond that is to seek understanding. I was talking with somebody the other day about Islam and Muslims, and they were really afraid. And I just said, how many Muslims do you know? There are 1.6 billion on the planet. How many do you know personally? And he looked at me and said, "I have never met a Muslim." I said, "Well, before you condemn 1.6 billion people, you probably should meet one." Right? Understanding changes the game. There are some people, again, we need to have boundaries with, right? People who are toxic or violent, those sorts of things. But what we don't understand, we fear. And the reality is, in the Bible, fear and courage is not the opposite of fear in the Bible. Love is. And when you're afraid, it kind of triggers all those older parts of your brain that say our group has to be safe against their group. And so when you're afraid, you immediately go into like caveman mode. You know what I mean? Like you've got your club and you're ready to beat people over the head with it. And the reality is sometimes there's danger, but sometimes it's the only danger is you don't understand. I don't understand. And we're afraid of what we don't understand. And we need to seek understanding. And the only way you can seek understanding is through education, and it's through actually getting to know people who you're afraid of a little bit. And I think what you'll find out is that sometimes the people you're afraid of aren't the ones you need to be afraid of. There's actually a story in the Gospels that really illustrates, I think, this in the life of Jesus. And it's a story found in Matthew 15. And in this story, Jesus encounters, he's in a Gentile area. So there are Jews and Gentiles, and the line between them was quite bold. And especially for Jews, they believed they were sort of God's people, and the Gentiles were going to get it in some ways. And so Jesus meets a Canaanite woman. Now, here's the problem with this. We know that in the first century when Jesus lived, there were no Canaanites. We know this. The other gospel that tells this story calls her a Syrophoenician woman. I think Matthew calls her a Canaanite for a very specific reason. He's wanting to tell a story and untell a story, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I want you to see something that happens to Jesus. Now, here's what I want to say up front so you understand where I'm coming from. Well, let me just read some of it, and then I'll explain that, because it'll make more sense when I read it. Jesus is in a Gentile region. A Canaanite woman from those territories came out and shouted, "Show me mercy, son of David." So she's using a Jewish messianic term, this Gentile. "Show me mercy, son of David. My daughter is suffering terrible from a demon possession." And Jesus responded, "She's just two. She'll grow out of it." Kidding. But he didn't respond to her at all. Let that set in. This woman is desperate for her daughter to be healed. And what does Jesus do? Doesn't respond. He ignores her. His disciples came and urged him, "Send her away. She keeps shouting out after us." It's sort of like, "Hey, boss, she's dragging too much attention. Get rid of her." Jesus replied, and he's saying this to the woman, "I've been sent only to the lost sheep, the people of Israel." Do you know what his answer is? "You're not part of my people. You're not part of my tribe. You're not my problem." Really? And she says, "Lord, help me." And Jesus says, "It's not good to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." Do you see what he's saying to her? We're the kids. You're the dog. So it's somewhat of, could be taken as a racial slur against Gentiles. That's how it was used in the ancient world. Now, how many of you, this is the first time you've read this passage. Anybody? How many of you, when you hear that, you're kind of like, "Jesus, no." Anybody there? Like, now, here's what I want to say about Jesus. I think we talked last week about Jesus embodies God to us, right? God is present in Jesus. Jesus was still a human being, and he was still a human being who was raised in a culture and a context. Paul says in Philippians that Jesus emptied himself of the rights of divinity. My assumption about Jesus is that he had no special information about the universe that nobody else had in his day, right? I don't think Jesus understood that the sun was at the center of the universe and everything went around it. I think Jesus was, in many ways, he had the information available to him, and he had this experience of God that he embodied to us. But I still think Jesus was a man of his time. He wouldn't have known things that weren't present in his time. And I think Jesus was also like us in that he was raised by a group of people. And his understanding of the world was, there are Jews and Gentiles, there are good guys and bad guys, there are kids and there are dogs, and I'm sent to take care of God's kids. These people are not my problem. Now some people say Jesus was just testing his disciples, and that's okay if that makes it easier for you to stomach. I think this is a moment where Jesus is struggling with something he's been taught his entire life. And what is he going to do about it? He says, "It's not right to throw the kids' bread to the dog." Now notice what the woman says back to him. She said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall off their master's table." Do you feel for this woman yet? Can you imagine your kid's sick and you're just trying to get the medical attention and the doctor refuses to treat them because of their nationality or their ethnicity? Can you imagine that? Because that happens in the world to people today. People are in this very circumstance in the world. And notice what Jesus says in response. "Woman, you have great faith. It will be just as you wish." And right then her daughter was healed. I think this is the moment for Jesus where he realizes something. He realizes his mission is bigger than one group of people. It's the world. And I think you see Jesus take a step forward that his brothers and sisters were not ready and could not take. And I think that's what makes it powerful. Jesus meets her, Jesus understands her, and Jesus heals her daughter. And you know what Jesus does next? He goes and he feeds 4,000 Gentile people. 4,000. And after the meal, there were 7 basketfuls of food left over. Now, that makes no sense until you realize that in the book of Deuteronomy, there were 7 nations that the Jewish people had been told to wipe out. 7 Gentile, Canaanite nations. Do you see why Matthew called her a Canaanite? Matthew is saying, in our past, we were told to treat those who were different with violence. We thought we were told. But what Jesus has revealed to us is that we've actually been called to treat those different, not with violence. We've been called to feed them and care for them and be their brothers and sisters. And I think for Matthew's community, Jewish community reading this gospel, it should have been, I think this was one of those moments where they begin to get the bigger picture of what Jesus was really all about. Not one group, but the world. Not our tribe, but everybody. That God's love isn't confined to a group. That God's love is as wide as creation. And everybody is loved. I mean, do you see how powerful that is? And when you really begin to seek understanding, when you sit down across the table from somebody different than you, somebody who sees the world different than you, it really is a powerful, powerful, powerful thing. And fear is divisive. Think about, I think sometimes, how many of you have ever changed any belief you've had religiously since you were a kid? Anybody changed their belief? When that happened for you, was it scary? Yeah. I can remember when I started to unravel about 2005, 2006, when everything I thought I knew was, actually it was 1999. It got worse then, but in 99, everything started unraveling for me. And I remember the fear that came with that because I just didn't understand. And the people who were telling me things that were different than I'd been taught, I was afraid of them. And I was quick to label them heretics. And it's interesting how it feels when the shoe's on the other foot. But, you know, you begin labeling them in different ways and saying things about them and condemning them. And the reality is that's just fear. And if we could pause the fear long enough to understand, we may not agree, but maybe we can move forward. Maybe we could at least understand where we're coming from, realize that I'm not dangerous and you're not dangerous. We just have a difference of opinion, and that's completely fine, right? I think part of what this means is that we have to realize people aren't problems to be solved. They're God's children to be loved, regardless of their labels. When people become problems to be solved, you end up with the Holocaust. Right? You got people who are a problem. What do you do with the problems? You eliminate them. And when we see any group of people as a problem, we're one step closer to genocide. But when we see them as people we may disagree with, we may find deep disagreement with, we may not agree on anything. They may say the sun is yellow and you think it's orange, reddish orange, whatever. Like there may not be any agreement, but you have to meet them as human beings first and foremost. And then finally, I'd say this. When we seek to honor the image of God in other people, it begins by honoring it in ourselves, right? This almost sounds biblical. I'm going to throw something out there. You tell me. Love your neighbor as? That is biblical. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love doesn't start with your neighbor. It starts with you, right? Because in so many ways, you cannot give love you haven't received. There's a story in the Bible where Jesus goes to dinner at a Pharisee's house and Jesus would literally eat with anybody. It's a tax collector on Tuesday, a Pharisee on Thursday. It's one of those things I love when people ask about our church. Do you mean this kind of person could go to your church? And you could fill in the blank with somebody from another religion. You can fill in the blank with anything. And my stock response is always, yes, they could come to our church. You could come to our church. Like anybody could come to our church. We'll even take you, right? Like we're not discriminatory about who we take. Everybody's welcome here. So Jesus is at a Pharisee's house. And this woman comes in who has a reputation in the community. She's known for her wild living. And she comes in and she weeps on Jesus' feet and dries them with her hair and pours expensive perfume on them. And the whole time this is happening, the Pharisee is sitting across the room going, if this Jesus were legit, he would totally know what kind of woman this was and he would kick her out of here so fast. And Jesus knows smug, self-righteous people. And so he says to the Pharisee, I know what you're thinking, but let me ask you a question. Can I tell you a story? If you're ever at dinner with Jesus and you do something that prompts a story, you're in trouble, right? Like you've done it. Anytime Jesus is like, you do something like, hey, can I tell you a story? You're like, oh crap, I knew it. So Jesus tells a story, and here's the story. There's a man who owed the Visa company $500. There was a man who owed Visa $50,000. $50,000. And Visa came in and forgave both of them their debt. Which one do you think will love Visa, the Visa company more? And the Pharisee, he knows. He knows he's busted. He says, I guess the guy who had the larger debt forgiven, because the bigger the debt, the harder it is to repay. And Jesus says that. You're absolutely right. And then he turns to Simon, this Pharisee, and he says, do you see this woman? And I think this is a loaded question. Simon obviously saw her. She came into the room. when he says, do you see this woman? I think he's asking beneath sort of this, do you see this woman? Do you know her story? Because we're all shaped by our story. Do you know what her relationship with her father was like? Did you know that both of her parents died when she was young and she was raised by somebody else who maybe didn't care for her as much as her? Do you know her story? Do you know what she has to do for a living? Do you think maybe she's choosing to be a prostitute? Or do you think maybe this is how she makes ends meet? Because in the ancient world, if you didn't have a man taking care of you, you were in big trouble. Do you know her story, Simon? Do you know anything about her? Or do you just know that she's a problem to be eliminated? I think that when Jesus says, do you see her? I think it's this explosive, like, have you really looked at her? When I entered your home, you didn't give me water for my feet, which was customary, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You didn't greet me with a kiss, but she hasn't stopped kissing my feet since I came in. You didn't anoint my head with oil. She has poured perfume on my feet. This is why I tell you that her many sins have been forgiven. So she has shown great love. The one who is forgiven little loves little. You know what Jesus is talking about? That love comes from the ability to have received love. Grace that you extend to others flows out of the grace you've been given. This is what Jesus is saying. Now, I think there's probably a temptation in Simon and us when he says this to say, well, I'm not loving very much. I guess that means I needed to be forgiven less than everybody else. That's not the point. What Jesus is saying is, Simon, y'all are on the same footing and you just don't know it. And those who've loved little have not been made aware of how deeply they've been loved. And those who have little grace for others have not been made aware. They're living without an awareness of how deeply God has given them grace, how much grace God has lavished upon them. Right? There's this sense that we can, if you know how to love somebody well, it's because somebody in your life probably taught you. Right? It may have been a parent, it may have been a teacher, it may have been a grandparent, it may have been a coach, it may have been somebody who lived on your street, but somebody taught you how to give love to other people selflessly. And if you're doing that, it's probably because you were taught to do that. And when we, if we want to be the kinds of people who honor the image of God in other people, we want to love other people well, we want to be compassionate and grace-filled toward other people, then we have to become aware of how we've received all those things too. We have to receive love. We have to honor the image of God in ourselves. I'm telling you, some of us talk about ourselves in ways that we would not talk about the worst animal on the planet. And when we talk about ourselves that way, it makes it easier to talk about other people that way. If I'm willing to call myself an idiot, it's much easier to see you as an idiot. Because it takes one to know one, right? If I'm willing to disparage myself, I'm willing to disparage you. It begins, this sort of honoring the image of God in others, it begins in us when we see ourselves as a valuable part of God's creation. Have you made mistakes? Have I made mistakes? Yes. Yes. Is there brokenness in us that needs to be healed and restored? Yes. Are there things that are getting in our way we need to leave behind? You better believe it. But at the same time, are we more valuable and loved than we could ever get our head around? Yes. Yes. And I would say honoring the image of God in ourselves enables us to become the kinds of people who become bringers of love and hope and joy and peace and compassion and grace and all the good things we want to have in our world. What enables us to do that is being loved well by God and then loving well out of that. So here's what this means for MCC. It means that every single human being who walks through these doors, regardless of their label or their story, they're welcome here. It means that they're loved here. It means that they have a place here. Right? That's what it means. And brothers and sisters, that is a hill I will bleed on every single time. When somebody asks me, if I come to your church, would I be welcome there? Because I might burst into flames. Somebody told me that the other day. I burst into flames. I was like, well, I'm still good. I just put on a little, I wear fire retardant clothing and I'm fine, right? That's what I do. That's how I get around that. And it's a shame that what religion has done is it's told people there are classes of people. There are good people and then there are people who burst into flames when they come into the church building. And the reality is everybody's welcome here. And if you're thinking of a group of people right now, them too. Everybody's welcome here. Everybody has a place. There's a chair for everybody. And we want to be the kind of church that looks at us, it looks at each other first and foremost, not based on how the world labels us, how culture labels us. We want to look into each other's eyes, and we are looking into the eyes of an image bearer of God who is deeply, insanely loved and who is full of potential and possibility and goodness that the world needs. And I hope that as we get together and honor that image, as we take that next step, that the world can only be better because we exist. Are you with me? Let's pray. God, we are grateful for each and every human being calls MCC home. We're grateful for our visitors and guests. We're grateful. We're grateful that we have a place where we can be honest. In some ways, we can bring our worst selves here and find hope and healing and a step forward. So wherever we are on our journey, meet us there and pull us forward. If we're dealing with some sort of hate or bias against a group of people, lead us on a step away from that toward love, compassion. If we're in the middle of self-loathing, lead us out of that to see ourselves as your loved children. Whatever that next step for us looks like, give us the courage to take it. Because we are your kids. Before we're anything else, we're your kids. Help us to act like it. Help us to treat one another like it. We pray in Jesus' name. And everybody said, let's stand together. Next week, we're going to talk about transformational community, which means that we figure that when we live life together, we can do better. That when we live in community with other people, we can be transformed, and it's a good and beautiful thing. You'll get to hear from some other people next week. You'll get to hear from a couple MCC folks and hear about their experience with transformation and community here at MCC. And actually, every week for the series, you're going to hear from people besides me. I'll be up there, but you're going to get to hear some stories. So please try to make sure you're back for that. If you're interested in helping with the children's ministry, see me, see Adra. My brothers and sisters, every last weird one of us is God's kid. Made in God's image. And so are all the people you'll meet out there today. So may we honor that, may we recognize that, and may we love that in ourselves and others. Grace and peace.